This is The Real Deal, providing the best insights on buying and selling small businesses. The Real Deal is presented by the International Business Brokers Association, the world's largest nonprofit organization for those helping others buy and sell businesses. Now, here's your Real Deal host, Chris Diglio.
Hello, and welcome to today's episode of The Real Deal. My name is Chris Diglio. I'm your host. Now, when I became a business broker 20 years ago, I had absolutely no experience, and I wondered, how in the world is anyone going to hire me to sell their business? So I wanted to be successful, so I sought out education. Thankfully, I found the IBBA, who not only had top-notch education, but they offered certifications from both the IBBA and the M&A Source that I could achieve through hard work, a lot of education, attending conferences, passing difficult exams, and so that I could have those most important letters after my name, the CBI and the M&AMI. It was very important to me for someone getting into the industry. So today I'm going to jump right into the show because we have a very special guest who's going to talk about a subject that's important to me, and that's professional designations. And when I was researching guests for today's show, I found an article that hit home to me. It was titled, Why Accredited Program Exams and Education Matter: Brief History of Professional Designations in the USA and Why Certification Matters. I then began to research the author of the article and soon realized I need to reach out to him and ask him to be a guest on our show. Now, his credentials speak for themselves, and even though he's extremely busy, he agreed to appear on today's show. My guest is Professor William Burns. He's the Executive Professor of Law at Texas A&M University School of Law. His areas of expertise are anti-money laundering and risk management, financial planning and wealth management, international taxation and taxation. And Professor Burns is one of America's most influential law authors. His Lexis and Kluwer legal treaties and tax fact books have sold more than 150,000 print subscriptions and are accessed more than 20,000 times annually by government attorneys, corporate tax and risk counsel, attorneys, and the Big Four advisors. William Burns has been called one of the leading authors and best-selling authors in professional markets. He's authored and co-authored more than 1,000 articles published by financial media. Professor Burns pioneered online education in the early 90s. He's certainly a pioneer and was way ahead of his time. He created the first online LLM offered by ABA-accredited law school, and Professor Burns has dedicated his life to education. He's been featured all over the world on CNN, ABC, NBC, Fox News, CBS News, The Wall Street Journal, and the USA Today, just to name a few. So, Professor Burns, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule and joining us today on The Real Deal.
Howdy. Welcome to y'all, too. I'm coming at you from Texas A&M here in the great state of Texas, and it's Howdy Week. So as I say, howdy. Well, I hope y'all didn't watch our tremendous loss to Auburn this Saturday, but we're coming back. We're coming back this weekend against the Razorbacks. But this is a sports program, so we won't talk college football.
I could do that all day long. I'm a big sports fan. It was a tough loss, but since it's Howdy Week, I'm going to say howdy right back to you. So,
so let's talk designations and the topic of today's show. I think, you know, if I go back 25 years to the early 90s, it was, you know, most people forget our history of like how we came to where we are today. And so names like MBA, this acronym for Master of Business Association, or even CFA or CFP for that matter, they just, it's always been around, but it hasn't always been around. For those of, you know, if you were alive in the mid 80s, and then you know that MBAs were rare, and they hadn't really caught fire yet, and there was a reason for that, and the CFP exam didn't even exist, and the CFA exam was something brand new and wasn't under that name. So how do we get to where we are? Universities have had a disconnect that's been going on since the 1960s, and the disconnect is that industry needs a certain skill set to be able to do its job. Universities are great at the term liberal arts. You get philosophy, you have art history, you have English literature. None of those are going to help me sell a business. They're going to help me with soft skills. They're going to help me write an effective memo, perhaps. My grammar is going to be correct, hopefully. They're going to help me perhaps present in front of an audience, perhaps, because we all went to university, we've been to college, and we know that actually the opportunities to write effective memos and to do presentations in front of audiences, not so often. In fact, I bet you, think back to your freshman year of university, and like me, you probably looked to your left and looked to your right, and there were 300 other people in the room with you, maybe 500. Psychology 101 or a course like that. So people graduate from university and they go for their first job, and they may know what I want to be. I want to do life insurance. I want to be in finance. I want to buy and sell businesses, but they haven't obtained any practical skill sets from university to help them. So they think, you know what? I'm going to go to business school. I'm going to go to law school. And guess what they find? They graduate 2 or 3 years later, and they're exactly where they were when they graduated university. They have some more liberal arts type education. If they went to law school, they know about evidence and they know about constitutional law. And they had fantastic discussions in the classroom on theory, on, you know, they've read academic articles. Not one of them has helped them buy or sell a business, sell an insurance policy, deal with a client. Same with the business school. The business school, they learned how to quantify. They learned how to use Excel spreadsheet. They still can't buy a business. They still can't. Where do you learn? So there's a skills gap. And where do you learn those practice-ready skills, as they're called today? And that's where your association comes in. Like the IBBA is filling a need to bring somebody who has these fundamental, I'll use this word, liberal arts type education, even they went to law school or business school, it's still a lot of professors who are really smart, who have PhDs, dissertations in an area, who, like me, want to talk about my area in the classroom. And my area, you know, I like to think it's very fascinating, transfer pricing. But maybe for somebody who wants to go into finance, perhaps my area, which is very economics-based, isn't going to help them with the art of the transaction itself, right? Unless I happen to have been in that place myself, how can I share that information with a student? So it's people who have been in this situation, who have the experience of the transaction, who have been in, I like to say, the trenches, and are in the trenches on a daily basis, so they understand the stresses. Because again, in university, from an academic's point of view at least, we have a year to think about an article. You know, for a typical academic article, we have all the time in the world, if you will. But in real business, you know that, you know, maybe you have 10 hours, 20 hours. The deal comes and you have a week to complete it sometimes. You're under stress, and that's one of two or three other deals you're working on. And you have labor issues, and you have the financing issues, and you have personalities and conflicts and the legal paperwork and the compliance. All of these, that's not taught in university. That's not even taught in law school. That's not taught in business school. So these acronyms, you know, JD for lawyers, MBA for the people who've gone to business school, even the lawyers don't feel they have enough to go for master's of law and LLM, and they still have a practice-ready skills gap. So like the IBBA comes along and says, how are we going to fulfill the needs we have in our industry, because we have firms like your own, and you want to hire two or three new people, but what you don't want to do is spend the next 2 or 3 years training them, because frankly, that's what education should have done in the first place. If you had 2 or 3 years to spend training your employees instead of getting the new client, instead of doing your client work, you'd be ready to sell your business anyway. You'd be at the retirement stage. So you would like at least in theory, you would like the university or the graduate school experience to be providing you employees who are competent to do the work that you need them to do within the first month of the job. Now comes the IBBA. You can actually, you know, tell your employees there is an option here to allow you to learn from experienced persons who have been in your shoes before, who have been entry level into the industry, who have felt the stresses that you're feeling. More importantly, they've done the transactions that you haven't done yet. they've been around the block, as we say, right? So they've seen all the things that go wrong. Usually when we learn from experience, it's a polite way of saying, I screwed up a bunch of times. And hopefully I don't, walk in the same hole again. So the times that we wish we could have done it better, the next time we do it better because we've captured that experience in a certification program like y'all offer. Professional designation is so important. It's the same reason a degree is important after education. You've done this intangible, 3 months, 6 months, maybe even a year of training, preparing for exams, taking in a lot of information, spending hours and hours of study and preparation and working with other people to gain the skill set, to do transactional skills. But you don't have an hour to explain that to a potential client, to a potential employer. The designation is the quality control mechanism. It's the cue, if you were thinking about linguistics, or the proxy, if we talk about economics, that allows, that communicates to the potential client, to the potential employer, that intangible 3-6 year of time, of study, of the intense preparation of the exams. It communicates it in one signal, the designation itself, that certification. So usually when I say certification, that's the examination process. When I say designation, that's what I would call in the university world a degree, right? It's the title, that it's the acronym, like an MBA for business schools, like a JD for law schools, an LLM for the masters, that tells the potential client or employer that you now have a certain skill set. Nobody in practice or in industry thinks that because you went to university or because you went to law school that you are practice ready. It just doesn't exist. They know you're not. It's the designation that lifts you across the skills gap.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because one of the things, I got into business brokerage 20 years ago, and as I mentioned in the beginning of the show, I knew absolutely nothing. And so I strived to learn, and I joined the IBBA, and after I gained my CBI designation and the MNAMI, then I oversaw the CBI designation and I was the chairman of education and the chairman of the entire association, because I felt like the more I learned, the more I wanted to give back. But I struggle sometimes because I talk to business brokers that are new to the industry and some that have been in the industry for a little while. And they look at me and they say, well, you don't need a CBI. You don't need an MNAMI. You don't need these designations. You just need to do deals. And I want to shake them if I could. You can't do that nowadays. You'll get thrown in jail. But it just bothers me, because I try to express to them why it's so important and what it means to the end user, the customer, the business owner that you're dealing with. And I'm like, if they don't understand what your designation is when you're done talking with them, they should have a great understanding, because there's a value and an importance behind it. So I'm so happy to hear you talk about that.
It's the old adage, don't reinvent the wheel. If I made 5 mistakes on 5 different transactions in international tax, and I can capture that information in a training program and share it with you in a meaningful way that you can learn it and not repeat those mistakes, how much is that worth? I had a boss, my senior partner, when I was doing my overseas, you'd call it an externship. It's like a stagiaire. I was employed, but my first 2-3 years of associate employee, he said, hey, your first 2 or 3 years, you have no value to me because I'm training you. And because I didn't have a designation process because I was too young. It didn't exist at the time for what I did. So, and he said, and at that time, this is now almost 30 years ago, he was $1,000 an hour. Now, nowadays, that'd be like in tax, it's nothing. It's what it is. But back then, it was just unheard of. And I said, it's like, I'm embarrassed. Like, we walk in and you're $1,000 an hour, and people pay it, but I'm embarrassed to even say that figure. It's just absurd. And he goes, and he tells me this story, and I'll never forget it. And it really keys into designations. He was already old. He was like 60 years old. He'd been through 35 years of tax deals, big tax deals, big multinationals, billion-dollar transactions. And he says, you know, they can hire you, my young associate, pay $200, $250 an hour. Back then, that was something, $200, $250 an hour. And you know what? You're going to take, it's like a mechanic. They're going to bring their car. You're going to take that engine apart, Every piece you're going to lay perfectly as you learned in school on the ground. You're going to map them out, and you're going to, and you go on the story, and you tell a little story about pulling that engine apart. And he goes, and then you're going to put the computer, and you're going to find the problem. He goes, and a week later, they're going to get their car back. But you see, they're going to come talk to me in a conversation, and within an hour or two, I'm going to look at them and go, I know what your problem is. Tell them that I'm going to take a wrench, I'm going to walk over to the car, I'm going to twist one piece, and they're going to drive out with their car. Now, even if your rate was so low that all those hours of the week were less than my 2 hours, my $2,000, their 1 week of time is worth more than your cheap rate. That's why I'm a $1,000 senior partner and you're my young stagiaire. I'll never forget that story. I learned over 3 years from all of his mistakes. And thankfully, I learned not to repeat those. And it was invaluable. And had that information been able to have been captured in a designation for what I, you know, international tax transactions, transfer pricing, my life would have been different because I wouldn't have had to spend 3 years. I could have spent 1 year, 3 months, 6 months, however long it takes to capture that experience, again, which is just a fancy way of saying a lot of mistakes, capture them so I didn't have to reinvent that wheel. Let me go out and make new mistakes, but let's not repeat the mistakes of the past. And your business brokers who are coming to you young, yeah, they can go out like me and spend 3 years of messing up. But in today's litigious society, like when I was doing it, there wasn't a lot of lawsuits about, again, you know, taxation at that time, but or business deals and so forth, like we know today. But today, when you make mistakes, the consequences are faster and higher. Lawsuits are filed with immediacy, and the quantum of damages are much higher because the duty is, there's a higher level of expectation from the professionals who are using you, but also from the public, the jury. And they expect you to know these skills gaps I'm talking about. Again, if you're going in blind, which is the same thing as going in without a designation, you are bound to repeat the same mistakes that the people who have a designation won't be repeating because they learned about those mistakes and how to avoid them in the future.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it just the importance, and not just the litigious side of it, right? Obviously, nobody wants to get sued because that could damage you and your career. But in today's society, the social media aspect of it, you wrong somebody, or you don't know what you're doing, or you do a bad job. Even if you do a good job sometimes and they think you did a bad job, they could post one message and can ruin your career.
Yeah, you bring up a good point, social media. Yeah, of course, that didn't exist either in the 80s and 90s when I was starting out. I'm a pioneer of online, so I really understand social media. And I understood, I was at a colleague, George Mintz. We'd grown up together. And George, not only did he understand social media, but he was somewhat of a math genius. and he really understood algorithms and how the search engines, which back then were called like InfoSeek, and I don't even remember all these spiders. We know now, of course, it's Google, right? Google's everything. But back then, there was like 10 different search engines to choose from. I mean, MSN was even a player, and Internet Explorer. So he figured out early on that he could use, in a positive way, social media to build businesses. But he also learned that, like a two-sided coin, the other side of the coin was very dark. And for, like you brought up, not even to wrong somebody, but if the expectation is, you might have done them great. You earned them $1 million. But their expectation, because they've read other social media, is 1.5 million. And they go on and say, you ripped me off $500,000. It's not, you made me $1 million. It's you ripped me off $500,000. Even though you made it, you can go online and defend yourself. I made them $1 million. But the expectation wasn't met. And those are the kind of, I'm not going to even call them mistakes. I'm going to call them expectation gaps that the young broker doesn't understand, that they can't know because it's an experiential thing that somebody with your experience can know and that you can, again, capture in a formal training program. You can't just sit down and have a beer and explain it one day. It has to be in a program that has mnemonics, that has a way for them to, as we say in education, pedagogy, or linguistics, to anchor this new information into their framework of what they already know. It has to be in a way that they can recall it. So having a beer with somebody for 30 minutes and explaining it, great, absolutely great. You've shared some wisdom, but you haven't shared it in a way that mnemonically it's going to forever stick with them. It had to be in some kind of, you know, thought out training program. We call it pedagogy, you know, so pedagogically sound program. I think with the internet today, it's not just that somebody can go flame you for your bad work, it's they can actually flame you for an expectations gap, which is almost a miscommunication. It's really an area of miscommunication. And communication in business is purely experiential. It's not something you can really teach in at university. Professors haven't been there, generally speaking, themselves. So they couldn't even pass on the information, even if they knew it to pass on, but they don't. They haven't been in that trench to understand the client's expectations and the lack of meeting them as an advisor.
You mentioned education, and that's so important. Everyone talks about designations, the importance. Why should I get it? What do those letters mean? Well, it's what's behind the designation. It's the education behind it, all the knowledge that you gain. And you're quoted as saying, before designing a course experience, I first research and assess the learners from the perspective of how that body of individuals consult and interacts with information. Our millennium age students and the next generation are digital immigrants that bring a different environmental interactive model to learning than the students of 20 years ago. Can you explain what it's like dealing with today's students compared to when you first started?
Well, one thing is a pet peeve, but again, it's today's students. I had to learn over it. When I was at the breaking age. I was at where computers hadn't yet been brought in. And so when I was learning, you were still given a book and expected to read the book. In fact, when I was in high school, I went to a special type of one of these like arts. If you won't remember the movie Fame unless you grew up in the 80s, right? You
can't remember
the term Fame in a classroom today because they don't know what you're talking about. They didn't grow up in the 80s. Michael Jackson's interesting, but frankly, that was some old guy. For the people today, kind of blows me away. But I went to the school like this, and they gave us a book a day to read, and they expected us to read it. When I was in, literally. And when I was in law school, you're expected to, you know, process about 300 to 500 pages a day. And those who couldn't got washed out. And that's the way it was. If you do that in today's world with today's millennials, you're washing out 100% of your class, or at least 90% of them, and then you go out of business. So that's not really an effective model today. Why is that? You know, of course, there's always going to be people say naysayer, it's not so. But there's a lot of literature now that is showing that the brain is being rewired, the circuitry of the brain, and I won't go to the, you know, the medical parts of it, but the circuitry of the brain has been rewired by the, you know, if, I'm going to say this just to be simple, but the, you know, the 3-second sound clip on YouTube or the 3-minute sound clip on YouTube. But the brain's been rewired to, instead of go deep, to go broad. So when I was growing up, one went deep because you had a book. Or you could go to the library and you could have 2 books or maximum 3 books that you could actually peruse and go through by tomorrow's class or, you know, a class in a couple days. It was almost possible. Today, the typical, you know, I have a 10-year-old in my house. She will process playing these games. They're really sophisticated. I love her games, actually. They're architectural 3D build stuff games. You know, they're not like their typical shoot 'em up games. So she's not going to be going to the military. She'll probably be an architect. But regardless, she can process literally, it's like the speed of light to me, but 50, 75, maybe even 100 websites within a matter of less than 2 hours playing a game. She's whipping through them, and I'm talking like 1, 2, 3 pages. She's on to the next one. Her young mind has been wired from the minute she could like see and perceive when she got her first little iPod-y, you know, device at, you know, 3 years old, and it's like, please don't make noise. Will you please play with the computer right now so I can work? We all did that back when I was growing up. It was like, here's the TV. Watch the TV. They're like, don't watch TVs anymore. What is this device? Oh, let me cast my iPad or cast my computer screen onto the TV. That's what these video boxes are for now. They don't watch TV. And she does actually. She watches everything she watches on YouTube by what we would kind of call influencers, but they're not. They're the old Phil Donahues who have their own TV programs, except they're like 15 or 16 years old. But they have hundreds of thousands of viewers who watch them weekly or even daily. And again, if you say Phil Donahue in a classroom today, you just got big eyes. What? Who? Huh? Right? Jerry Springer. And it's still big eyes. I don't know who you're talking about. Right. You say Oprah, they're like, oh, yeah, we've heard of Oprah. But they don't really know who she is. They just, yeah, we've heard of her. That's today's millennial student. So first of all, you have to come at it in the shoes that they are growing up in. And if they're growing up using smartphones to access information, if their ability to go deep requires that you break information up into small, instead of giving them a book, you give them small chunks. It's not you're giving them less, you're serving it up in a different way. So if my kid doesn't like mashed potatoes, I bury the mashed potatoes in yummy stuff like the gravy and the butter, and I make it look different. Whatever. I don't give them a lump of mashed potatoes. I still want them to eat the mashed potatoes. You're just serving the information and the training you want up. Now, in a way, it makes our job harder as educators, but in a way, it makes it more fulfilling. What the people want today that we did not perhaps we receive when you and I are growing up. They expect the classroom to be more entertaining. And it doesn't mean we're clowns in the classroom. It means that we have to make the materials come alive. And this brings it back to designations. They want real-world applications. And you have the classroom and university with theory and academics, and the students can't embrace a framework to place this information in, and it evaporates. And that's what people get out of college. And like, what'd you learn in college? I don't know. I had a good drink. I was great in parties I went to, but I don't know what I learned. But you do learn from a training program, from a designation. Why? Because the designation's information has, first of all, served it in a way that the student can appreciate it. Two, it's brought it to a real-world application, and it's that real-world application that today's student expects because they can review 50, 75, 100 websites. They will, if they don't understand what they're looking at, they're going to find the information necessary to understand what they're looking at. And so for them, that's looking through websites and YouTubes and all that real world application, because they're 10 years old, they're 8 years old. They're not working in business like you and me. But today's millennials, if they're trying to learn about M&A deals and buying a brokerage, they're going to be on that YouTube. They're going to be on that internet. They're going to be searching through blogs, and they're going to be doing it fast. And 2 hours later, they're going to be like, I know something. If you can't organize your information in a way that can be appreciated by that group of students, it's, again, this miscommunication of expectations gap. They're expecting this connection with again, I'm going to use the word entertainment, but I don't mean it in a negative way. I mean it in a very positive way. They're expecting it in a way that it has real-world application, that they can perceive that you're using live examples that make sense to them today. You're not saying Phil Donahue. You're saying, I don't watch the TV talk show people today, but I could say Rush Limbaugh on radio. Nobody knows who that is today. The 20, 30-year-olds even, they don't know who Rush Limbaugh is. You can't say that. You have to say somebody today that's relevant to them today. You have to refer to deals that are done in the last decade. You have to refer to music that's in the last decade. So if you've built a program that – I'm not going to say any universities. That would be disparaging. But let's say that your university is very famous, very high-branded, very high-ranked. For a program that it's been resting its laurels on for 100 years, the expectation gap is so huge. And, yeah, you can take a mallet and beat the students' heads to try and force them to rewire for your program. But the whole world is rewired in the millennial sense, because they are the world 10 years from now. They're the majority of workers. They're the majority of managers. And this is why people who are like 60 years old start to feel not relevant. And they're like, oh, I can't get a job. I can't get hired. Even 50-year-olds today, I hear this from 50-year-old colleagues. Oh my God, I hope I don't get fired. I can never get a job. I'm too old. What I'm really hearing is I haven't kept up with the new expectations expected of me. I tell 50-year-olds all the time, and I'm over 50, so I'm okay saying this, right? I tell, you know, people my age, and I tell, we're highly experienced, but I tell people my age, what have you done to reskill and retrain yourself lately? This summer, I went to a 2-week intensive economics and econometric type course. This is me, William Burns, who has 20 plus years of writing books every year in education. This summer, I went to another 2 weeks retraining of my mind for current economics. Why? Because I want to not only stay relevant, I want to stay ahead of the curve. I want to be innovative. And so when I have 50-year-old colleagues tell me, oh my God, if I get fired, I can get a job. What they're not, it's not because of their age. In fact, their age is a plus. Their age hopefully means I have 30 years experience or 20 years experience in making mistakes that I can communicate in a cohesive manner and not make those mistakes again for the 25-year-olds you're hiring today. Because guaranteed, unless they got a designation and they've learned from somebody like me, they're going to make those mistakes. And we don't have the time, back to my analogy with my senior partner, we don't have the week for the car to be taken apart and rebuilt. Today, we really want stuff done today. Millennials want it done today. Tomorrow's too late for them today.
But that's why I asked you about the millennials, because, you know, age does matter and designations do matter. Age matters because when I was a business broker, I started out at 28 years old and I was very young for the industry. But, you know, the average age of a business broker, I jokingly say back then was dead. You know, it was the person that was on their third or fourth career and they said, well, I'll sell businesses now. But, you know, when you're 28 years old or now, I see a lot of millennials, I see a lot of young people entering much younger than 28 years old, becoming a business brokers and selling people's business. But when you walk into that company that somebody's owned for 25 years and they look across the desk at that individual that is just out of school or has no experience whatsoever, the importance of having that designation and being able to say, hey, I might be young, but I know what I'm doing. I mean, the designations, I think, speak volumes because you have the age aspect against you.
I agree with you 100%. And to me, it's about that they won't repeat the mistakes. For really young mind, like, you know, a 10-year-old, even a 3-year-old, they don't know how to say no. They don't know what no means, and that's great. So they're willing to stretch and push the envelope, push the box open, and the, you know, the terms like think outside the box. You know, they don't know what a box is. So they're willing to explore areas where sometimes age holds us back, and we're like, oh, you can't do that. And we can't see outside our own box. But in general, that also gets you into trouble. Innovation works both ways. So when we were like, you know, coming up as a human race, human beings, there is like 9 out of 10 people ate the berries and died, right? They ate the berries, got sick and died. And we're the survivors. Like everybody alive today survived because 9 of our compatriots a million years ago ate some berries and died. When I look at the 25-year-old, I'm like, you're young and you're energetic and you're creative and you don't know like your advantages, you don't know, but your disadvantages, you don't know. And don't knowing today to me is dangerous. Like I want you to be able to push the envelope. And I also don't want you to know that like working 80 hours isn't normal. I want to tell my 25-year-old, yeah, of course, everybody works 90, 100 hours a week because they don't know.
Right.
They don't know. Let them. I need that labor force. But that's how law firms work, right? That's how the military works. The 18-year-old doesn't know that everyone doesn't charge forward. And we need that to be. Otherwise, we didn't get anything done. On the other hand, not knowing is really dangerous. And if it's my business being sold and I have the 25-year-old or 50-year-old make a mistake, all I know is a mistake was made and I got 1 million instead of 1.5 million, or I got nothing, or I got sued as the business seller, or my business didn't get sold, or what have you, because a mistake was made. All I know is a mistake was made. So if they don't have a designation, if I'm not secure that they're not going to repeat common mistakes, and if you tell me, oh, well, I have an MBA, I mean, I'm in education, so I really get it. But I think most people get it nowadays. I think if you listen, there's a movement in San Francisco And it was shocking to me as an educator. The movement started a little over 10 years ago now. It started in the right around 2005. And the movement was drop out. And it's kind of the Steve Jobs movement. But it was the point was is that people said, I'll even pay you to drop out. They meant, I'll give you a job. I don't want you to waste the next 4 years not learning anything, you know, having parties and going to events and all that, but really not learning anything, or worse yet, learning wrong because some professor who's never been in the trenches told you it was this way. And in a way, by having professors do that, because I have many colleagues, and I do have to fault them for this. And when I was, thankfully, the education that I went to was well-rounded. I mean, if a professor was the most socialist ever, because I had the most social democratic professor ever in economics, thank God he was so great. He literally taught us every argument for the most right to the most moderate to the most. He taught us everything. We had a well-rounded, and he strenuously argued his side. And that's not what happens today. Today, you're in school, whether it's an MBA or back at university, and the professor's like, it's my way or the highway. And so students learn to repeat to get that A, to excel exactly what the professor wants, and not to give the professor what they want. I'm not saying this is all the time, but we've all seen this. And not only that, but society knows this. It is a common understanding in society today that university and academics in particular, it is so detached. In fact, we have a term for it. We call it the ivory tower. It is so detached from how the real world is, and worsening so that that students who come out begin to believe that the world is only road A. There's no such thing as road B and C. So they're the worst off. The 25-year-old coming today, 25-year-old, they're not at the point where they don't know that things aren't the way that they are necessarily. They don't have the creative and innovative instincts. So that's why in San Francisco, they were like, drop out. Don't go to university. It's actually worse off for you because you're not going to have that young instinct of just everything's possible. But you know who's telling them to do that? The Steve Jobs, the older investment banker who's been through the experience, who knows when to say no, who knows the dangers of the mistakes. So it's not like 25-year-old telling a 25-year-old, it's you saying, you know what, training on the job is better. And in fact, their job was the designation. Going to work for the Steve Jobs or the investment bank became the designation. The fact that you worked for Apple was your designation on your CV. But there is no Apple in your world of business brokerage and so forth. You all, in your industry in particular, again, there's no MBA that's going to help you sort this out. There's no law school course, generally speaking. They're getting better, but they, generally speaking, still the professors haven't been in your shoes. So they can't give you the transactional mistakes and experiences. The 25-year-old has to go out and acquire those from somewhere, and hopefully it's not from learning by making those same mistakes on the job. So, hats off to y'all for having, put in the time to create a successful, meaningful, so pedagogically meaningful education program. Without
y'all, we appreciate that.
A lot of danger out there for people wanting to sell their business.
We appreciate that, and the IBBA and the M&A Source have done a great job. And Professor Burns, I could talk to you all day long. In fact, I'm sitting here listening and talking with you, forgetting that we're doing a podcast because you're so fascinating, and the things you talk about that hit so close to home for me, and that are so dear to me. But before we go, though, I want to ask you one more thing. What advice would you give to the people listening to the show that they're on the fence about whether they should or should not, strive to obtain their professional designation? I think I know the answer, but I'd like to hear you say it again.
I think there's three different peoples who need it, to be sure. Those who are in school today, who want to start their job ahead of the curve. Those who are just starting in the career, who realize that they just went through school and they know nothing. And I'm going to say it again, the 50-year-old who's thinking, I'm not sure I'm relevant anymore. So for the ones who are in school, I think it is critical in the competition for jobs to apply for your position saying, I am smart enough to understand that I need this skills gap expectation met when I come to you. I think that's a strong signal to an employer. It says to the employer, I'm able to research what industry needs and to accomplish it. So right there, you've sent a strong signal you're going to get the job over everybody else. Number two, I entered the job. I think it's important for the employer to go to the new employee and say, I need you not to make mistakes on the job. And frankly, it's not my job to train you. You went to university. You have student debt for that. We can prove that you went to university. You're carrying a loan. And I'm already paying for your loan through the job. I don't want to also pay for your loan and have to train you. That's twice out of my pocket. So here's a designation, and some employers help pay for it. They half and half. Some just say, listen, you should have done this on your own. Hey, it's not my fault that you just spent $40,000 on your university education and this loan. I'm willing to give you a job to help you pay it, but you need to solve your skills gap. So however one does it, I think it's critical for the employer to protect the employer. This isn't about the student's interest. This is the employer's interest. Protect the employer by saying, go out and get this designation, however they arrange the financing of that designation. Thirdly, the 50-year-old. If the 50-year-old who's been through the experience, but something else that designations allow is they allow us to break from the daily routine of work. This is the same reason I went back for a 2-week, and when I say intensive, I do mean 7 in the morning till literally 10 at night course, 7 till 10, 7 days a week. Great course. and exhausting, but for the 50-year-old, it gives us a chance to break from the routine and to rethink and reposition the information that we do know into a framework that can help us excel for the next 10 years of our career, call it the golden years of our career. If we don't take that moment of time to pull, and you can't do it while you're in the trench, you have to get out of the trench. This is why troops leave the battlefield and go do R&R, right? You have to get out of the situation. You have to reflect, process. We all process, right? We go home and we turn on the TV. That's the worst type of processing. What we should do is go home and speak with people who are affiliated with what we do. That's when you talk over a beer. That's yes. When you talk over a coffee and you process, right? And you lightly talk about it and start to make frame, but that's not the designation. Okay, now I've got my brain where it's free from the immediacy and I'm being able to like think about some of the bigger picture and where it all fits in. I need to talk with other experienced people who can help me frame what I know because I hadn't been through the designation when I was 28 years old. I'm going to stay relevant. It's going to make my last 10, 15 years of my career exciting because right. It's going to help me to better frame and understand. It's going to remind me of doing why I do what I do. And if I'm not refreshing myself, I am going to be like my colleagues who say, my God, I hope I don't lose my job. I'm not going to be relevant. There's some 28-year-old who's going to take it. Instead of being, I'm the golden year experienced guy who's going to help moderate the lack of understanding of the ability to do everything of the young people who can make mistakes. I'm going to help mentor them with my knowledge and experience because I now understand it in a framework. I'm going to help mentor them along the path to be successful because presumably I'm successful at that point.
No, and that certainly is commendable. And before we wrap this up, you know, I believe that everyone now understands or they should understand the importance of the designations. And if they're not striving to get them, then either they just didn't listen to you, they just don't care, or I don't know what the problem is. But I have to ask you one question off topic very briefly before we go. I mean, it's not like you do enough things in life. You're an expert in law and taxes and wealth management. You're a professor. You teach. You go on all these media outlets and you write articles and books, but I read that you design suits. Where in the world did you start that, and how do you find time to do that?
So I'm going to tell you, this is about your designations as well. Innovation you're not just innovative in one area. Innovation carries and creativity carries into all your areas. You know, if you're a great business broker, it's not that you're going to be a great chess player. Chess has rules and all that. But you know what? You're going to be fascinated maybe by, you know, plays, or you're going to be able to draft short stories or whatever. In my case, my creativity works in such a way. I'm really good at designing corporate structures, if you will. This may not make the logic sense to you, but therefore I can design a great suit. And therefore I can see patterns, and I can mix and match colors. I'm not going to explain it to you in tax. It would bore you. But this is in fashion. In tax, if I want to do things right, I start from the very beginning with clients. I mean, I start from the very beginning of their transaction. They're like, well, I just want to talk about the transaction. Well, let's back up. How'd you start? Well, let's talk about all the businesses. Let's talk about the employees. But why? I go to the source, first of all. I want to get the right materials. So I'm going to learn about the source of materials, and I'm going to go purchase the materials myself. I'm going to get a list of, you would call it brokers. I'm going to get a list of tailors. And my tailors don't have to be located in the United States. I might have a tailor in China, one in Vietnam, one in New Orleans, where I'm from, one in Texas, where I live now. I do, this is true. And then I'm going to, you know, present it to them as, this is what I'm thinking about doing. What do you think? Because guess what? They've made mistakes before. They're the experts. So tell me your mistakes, right? Because I think I can do anything. I'm the young 28-year-old. I don't have a designation in fashion. But I honestly, I'm as soon as I have time, I'm going to go get a designation in fashion, because there's a lot of things I do wrong. And I need somebody like you who's been in the industry, the fashion for 20, 30 years to explain these to me. But I've been doing it now for 20 years as a hobby. So I'm not actually, you know, in the trenches doing it. But I now have designed about 300 types of suits with colors and patterns that cross each other that you don't think match together. But then when you see them actually on somebody, and the reason I know this, because I have thousands of followers, I'm not a fashion person. I'm certainly not a model, but thousands of followers. They're like, hey, can you explain to me what, you know, materials or fabrics or combinations you're using, so I can go to my tailor? And so I have this informal network, and they come to me and I share this with them, and vice versa. I'm like, hey, you know, I saw what you're wearing today in this picture. Can you do this? I go to Fashion Week in New York, and I get invited to Milan. I don't always have time to go, but, you know, and I'll go to Paris. And because they think I'm somebody because I have all these books, and, you know, they don't realize I'm not a fashion person. They invite me along.
Kudos to you. When I read that, I said, I've got to ask him about that. Whether we have time or not, I'm going to ask that question, because I was fascinated by that.
Well, I think you're going to find that the people in your courses at the IBBA are fascinating beyond, because they're great business brokers and they were willing and smart enough to put in the time to get their designation. These same groups of people are going to bring a myriad of other experiences in their life that are going to make it interesting for clients to use them in the future. Often the client is not gotten because, oh, I'm the best business broker in the world, come to me. The client's gotten because you're at an art show and you're looking at a painting, or they're looking at it, or you approach them about a painting, and that client happens to own a $3-4 million book of business and wants to sell it, and they're appreciating the art, and now you have a common connection and you just got the next deal. That's how a lot of deals in business are actually done, right? Because we're able to use our soft skills, again, that you only learn in designations. So hats off to y'all again for putting this together for your industry of brokers. Without it, you know, again, there's going to be a whole lot of mistakes and a whole lot of bad feelings. And y'all are helping to correct some of that. And, you know, the proof is in the pudding. Y'all have a lot of, you know, people have been through your program, and it's highly successful. I've only read really good reviews, and that tells me that people are getting a lot of value from it.
Thank you so much. And again, I know the listening audience is going to gain so much valuable information and better off because of you giving of your time. I know I am. I learned a lot, and it was so interesting and so fascinating talking with you. And I wish you the continued success and all the things that you do. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
100%. And, you know, root for Texas A&M at the Razorback game this Saturday.
Yeah. All right. Well, one last time, I'm going to tell you howdy, since it's howdy week.
Howdy.
Well, You know, thank you, Professor Burns, for coming on today's show. If you'd like to read more about Professor Burns, you can Google his name. Last name Burns is spelled B-Y-R-N-E-S. Or you can visit the Texas A&M website, law.tamu.edu/faculty-staff. Or you could follow him on LinkedIn, William Burns, or on Twitter, at William Burns. We thank you very much for listening to today's episode. I certainly hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you're a business broker, go out and get your CBI and your M&AMI. After listening to Professor Burns, I'm sure you understand now why you should have it if you don't. If you enjoy the Real Deal podcast, please share this on your social media platforms and help us spread the word. For more information on our show or to listen to more episodes of The Real Deal, visit us at ibba.org/the-real-deal. Again, thanks again for listening to today's episode on the importance of professional designations. I'm your host, Chris Diglio, and I look forward to talking with you again on the next episode of The Real Deal.